right. Hey, guys, and welcome to the Three Drinks In podcast, episode number 277. I'm your host, Vince. Over there is your host, Phil.
Hey.
There he is. In this episode, we're talking about the feel-good movie of the summer. That's not true. We're talking about last year's Oscar winner for Best International Feature Film, The Zone of Interest, which was not feel-good at all. But before we get started, we want to ask you to please subscribe to the podcast on any of those streaming services, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Make sure that you leave a 5-star rating, maybe even a review. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @ThreeDrinksInPod. You can like us on Facebook, and you can email us at threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. Last of all, don't forget to check out our merchandise over at tpublic.com. So yeah, not a feel good movie.
No.
Yeah, I thought it was a German film, and it's not. It's a British film. So
fun. Well, that's good. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I put it on. I put the subtitles on because I was like, they're speaking German, but it already had subtitles. So every subtitle just said speaking German. Let's turn it back off.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I got that. It was like covering the actual English. I was like, okay, they're speaking German.
Yes, it's true. All right. So let's do a little level setting here. This is, I don't know, a tad more serious a film than we typically do.
Yeah, you're not picking the next one. I'm picking the next one.
Yeah, it's a bit of a tonal jump from Die Another Day to this movie. I had wanted to see it. I had really been interested in seeing it. And
yeah.
I mean, what? Go ahead.
It's fine. You just ruined my Wednesday night. It's fine. I don't care.
Yeah. No. It's not supposed to make you feel anyway. No, but it's so like I heard of it and it was like, oh, that's an interesting perspective without being gimmicky. And that's sort of what I appreciate about these kind of movies is that like they're going to tell a story in a specific way that's not designed to be a gimmick. And that's always interesting to me. I'm also very interested in sound design. And it's one of those things where like, I don't quite get it, and I know that like this is a visual medium, and there's a lot more to be said about how a film looks than how it sounds. The same thing is true for theater, where I tend to do a lot of my work as a amateur film a theater director and actor, in like local community theater type stuff. But I've always felt that with sound, it's I've always been much more affected by it. And this is true for both sound design and musical scores and needle drops. And to me, it's always been a very interesting way to engage with the audience. It's also, when it comes to music, a very sort of easy way to emotionally manipulate the audience as well. So, good example of this was... You don't watch The Bear, so I'm not going to ruin anything here for you. But like those of you who watch The Bear, and I just watched the season finale for season 3 last night. And there's this scene where the main character, you're kind of going back and forth in his life throughout the course of the season. And the episode opens with him meeting with the very famous chef Thomas Keller of the French Laundry. And it's just a scene where he's talking to this guy about how to prepare a roast chicken for family meal for the restaurant's cooks. And Thomas Keller is him playing himself. He's not a good actor. He's just there just being awkward and telling a story to this this actor. And it's supposed to be a transformative moment in this guy's life. It's like he has this conversation with like a mentor and a guy he's admired for years, and it's powerful and it resonates with him. And then I'm sitting there watching and going, yeah, this is really powerful. And it's also very badly performed dialogue by a non-actor in a TV show who's there because all the foodies are going to recognize, ooh, that's Thomas Keller. He's famous, and that's why this is important. I should be paying attention to it. And then I realized that, like, you're made to feel that way because the score behind you is sort of like, it's perpetually emphasizing the importance of the interaction. Kind of like how in The Dark Knight, the Hans Zimmer thing, where, like, that one violin chord just kind of like progresses to nowhere and goes on and just increases the tension of certain scenes. Do you recall that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So think about something that does that same thing, but instead of making you feel uneasy, it makes you feel, I don't know, like heartwarmed or something. Like, it's like, this is a tender, interesting, important moment. It was the exact opposite emotional reaction, but with the same kind of music effect. And so it just reminded me, like, you know, this is a really important part of how to tell stories, is how to make the sound do something important and interesting. And so when I heard, like, they made a movie about Auschwitz and there's no music and it's all about the sounds you hear, and I was like, okay, that sounds both horrifying and fascinating. And it was. So for those of you who don't know, this is a movie about the commandant of the Auschwitz concentration camp, whose name was, I'm going to pull it up here real quick, Rudolf Hess? Or is it Haas? Rudolf Haas.
Yeah, Haas.
Haas. And it's really a story about him and his wife and being a Nazi in, you know, Austria, as, you know, a high, very important, you know, highly ranked member of the SS, and the life that they lived in the concentration camp. And the interesting thing about it is that you don't see anything. You don't see any of the horrors that are going on just on the other side of the wall of their home. It's about them and their family. And
They're not in the concentration camp.
Correct. They're physically inside of it, but they're not prisoners. They are running it.
Right. Well, the wall of the concentration camp borders their property. Like, they live in, like, a white picket fence house that shares a wall with all the barracks and crematoriums and everything like that. So, like, they can come and go as they please because they're in charge of everything, and all the horror and murder and death is happening 15, 20 feet away.
Yeah, I mean, just right
brick
there.
Wall, and they're separated from it purposely, you know.
Right. And it's about, you know, them living out, you know, not normal lives, but lives that approximate the banality of those that, you know, you and I live. And, you know, all the while, these, you know, unspeakable horrors are happening, like you said, like, it's just a few feet away. And, you know, what we all find fascinating about the Holocaust, those of us who admit it happened, is, you know, the banality of it. Like, I heard a thing on TikTok the other day. It was this historian guy that shows up every so often on my feed, talking about how the Nazis were very careful to rule out sadists when they were looking for people to run their operations. And they really wanted, you know, men who were just kind of come in and, you know, very perfunctorily do their job. And the very famous German philosopher Hannah Arendt always talked about how, you know, the 20th century brought with it the amazing bureaucracy of war, where before you'd heard stories about honor and valor and, you know, grand ambitions and plans and death. And, you know, the bulk of World War One and Two, you know, especially, you know, from the, you know, from the German standpoint, it was all about how do we, you know, do this as passionlessly and as efficiently as possible, and what kind of people are required to, you know, actually make that happen. And it's hard to imagine how that actually functions day to day. And so this is an opportunity for you to see that. And the emphasis is on, you know, what you cannot see, but what you can, of course, hear. And you can see some things, which we'll get to, I'm sure, but like you hear everything all the time. So that's the gist of the film.
I mean, that's the gist of it. What did you think of The Zone of Interest?
I liked the movie. I did not like the experience of watching the movie, which is a thing, like, we've talked about films like this before. Like, we all, you know, it's hard to say we liked Schindler's List, because it's, you know, it's horrible. But we...
Yes.
I mean, like, I think about movies like Logan, which you really liked, and I think I would have liked if I'd known what I was in for. I still never forget that. That's like my standard example of like, I didn't know what I was getting into when I walked in, like, oh my God, this was not what I expected. And like, had I known what I was getting into, I would have liked the film more. I would have enjoyed the experience as I was watching it. With Schindler's List and this, I know what I'm getting into. I don't like what I'm seeing. And I think it's important and I can appreciate what I'm watching. And I think it's executed extremely well. You feel guilty for saying that you liked the movie, but I liked the movie. Like I kind of want to say that just because I think it's important. Like, I did like it. I thought it was well made and it held my attention, which is more than I can say for most things. So I watch most movies now at home. And it's like, do I pick up my phone? How often am I, not really paying attention and like sort of looking away or doing whatever? And, the fact that this is a movie in German makes it sort of hard to do that. Like, look away and like scroll on Instagram or whatever. But like, I didn't feel like I missed that. Like, I was engaged with the film the whole time. And, I thought it was extremely well made, and it was great. I thought all the performances were good. It was, at points it was chilling, and there was a lot of interesting choices being made. And I thought it's a great movie. I think it's also like not one I'm ever going to watch again. But it was also
It's not something you'd watch more than once.
No, and like it's. That's okay. It's just like it's, but I thought it was great. I think it's very important as well too. So, what'd you think?
It's funny when people always say that it's important. I don't know how true that is. I don't know. Sometimes it is. Well, I mean, obviously, it's the most depressing subject matter in the history of modern mankind. So it's not like you throw it on while you're making dinner or anything like that, that's not one of those. I actually didn't like it.
Really?
As a movie. I don't know why this couldn't have been like an 8-minute YouTube video that you can show in history class. It's unnecessarily long. Because the plot, such that it is, doesn't kick in until about a third of the way through. And it's hard to care about it because everyone in the movie is so horrible. And I don't mean horrible like, this person's a jerk. I mean, these people are literally evil. And the point of the evilness in the movie is that it's bureaucratic, banal, everyday lack of empathy kind of evil. This was the man, he was a real person who helped design and implement gas chamber policy and gassing them to death because shooting them was taking too long. So like his whole thing is, well, how can we speed this process up and get it moving? Like they're just, items on a conveyor belt, and then his family members, like his wife and everything, are taking everything that was stolen from all the people who were murdered, fur coats and jewelry and all that stuff. So they're just watching people be evil. They keep the Polish people in their house as slaves, basically. I was like, these are monsters. I'm watching monsters. And that's powerful and dramatic and all of those things. And the movie is shot in such a way as to highlight that banality. Like, there's not a lot of fancy lighting. There's no fancy tracking shots. Everything is sort of eye level with the people in the house. You see them on like hanging out by like the riverside and things like that. Just taking in the nice day, It's beautiful country out there.
It really is.
But the plot is that they're transferring him. And they don't really want to go because they have it so good in this house. Like, they get everything they want. The land is really nice. He tries to show how good he's been at the murdering, that he doesn't want to get transferred. And there's a slight hint at the end that he sort of feels bad about what he's doing. It's the smallest little moment after an hour and 45 minutes. But famously, he was one of these Nazis that absolutely felt no remorse at all. Like, even when they were hanging him in Auschwitz at the end of the war for war crimes, he was kind of like shrugging, like, I wish I hadn't done that. But like, he had no emotion in his voice. They said, like, he was one of the few. They were like, I really didn't give a shit about
Yeah, I
murdering
mean,
millions of people.
he that's why, you read about these guys after the fact because you go, who, this is a real person? And so apparently he had written to his family to say, like, okay, this whole thing, not the best idea we ever had. So like, he regretted that he was so taken in by everything and like just kind of went along with everything without much of his, like he surrendered so much of himself to the collective that he didn't have an independent thought left in his head. And so there was some complaint about, but you're right, like, he did not have like a, a lot of them just denied, like, I didn't do it. Like, they, it was just the Shaggy defense up and down the wall. It was like, it wasn't me. Just, no, I don't know. I don't know who you're talking about. I don't know. I was not there. I was this guy. There were no Jews. I don't know. Like, they, and it was almost preposterous. Him was like, yeah, well, we did that. Guess we shouldn't have. Like, it was very sort of cold. And like, clearly, this was a person who wasn't well. We talk a lot these days about the overdiagnosing of people. People who say that they have OCD or they have autism or they're on the spectrum, or like, we're very engaged with like diagnosing our personalities in such a way that like it excuses our behavior. But there's clearly was something wrong with this person, that he could not function as a human being in the same way that you or I
I
can.
mean, you'd have to lump them all, a lot of them in there with that,
And that's, that was by design. Like, they just went like, who can we get to do this? And like, they all, found the kinds of people they were looking for. They didn't want the sadists, fine, but they wanted the soulless. And if you want to diagnose the soulless as having some sort of like, emotional regulation issue, then fine. But like, you get enough of them in the same room and terrible things can happen. But that's,
Yeah, so as a movie, I don't, it's not boring, but you do start wondering, like, where is this going? Because how many scenes and things do I need to watch of horrible, soulless monsters behaving this way? And there's a lot of them, and they're very powerful, Like, I'm not saying that any of that stuff was not done well. It's just that, like, it couldn't hold my interest. I didn't want to watch it because the subject matter was so hard. So I was like, this is very powerful. And like, this is a very good example of how the thing that Elie Wiesel always said in his memoirs is like, true evil is the absence of people doing the right thing. It's not the behavior of bad people, it's good people not acting. Sure, watching the women steal things, watching them be like, and all that stuff. So I was just like, well, why is this an hour and 45 minutes? I wanted it to be over after 10, Like, show this to history class. That's great for that. But the rest of it, I was like, yeah, I don't want to watch this.
So
Like,
I was just watching today, like, I scrolled through like, YouTube and TikTok and other kinds of things, and there was this scene from Better Call Saul when they bring in the German guy to talk about the building of the meth lab that Gus wants to build below the laundromat. And it's, you know, he's basically explaining to Mike, okay, this is what we have to do. And what you're telling me is I have to do this in complete and utter secrecy. And he goes through all the different calculations. And then there's the scene with Gus and Mike in that giant airplane hangar where they have all these like fake houses in there. He's like, okay, well, here's what you need. You need beer on tap. You need treadmills. You need basketball hoops. You need, you know, TVs and foosballs. And like, we have to keep these men locked up in here every day for like 10 months, almost a year of their lives is going to exist in this airplane hangar and underground. Like, how are we going to make this work? And I think it was you mentioned it, but like somebody was talking about how that was how, you know, Vince Gilligan thought about a lot of the things in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul was like, well, how do you accomplish these things? Is there drama and storytelling to be had within the intricacies of like how these crimes are actually achieved? And the answer is yes. Like it's fascinating, you know, if you make it about process that you can, you know, it's a challenge. Like it's always about, you know, people think it's about results, and everyone wanted things to be over quickly and dramatically and, you know, very excitingly. And sometimes that's not where the, you know, where the interesting bits lie. They lie in the process. And so, you know, the process here is like, how do the people function in this environment? Like, what is the process like to actually run a concentration camp? You know, yeah, there's like the scene where he meets with those guys who talk about like, we've created the best ovens for burning people quickly and efficiently. And it gets up to 1,000 degrees and then back down to 40 degrees Celsius. And like, we can just crank them out. No problem. You know, so there's those scenes. And then there's the scene where he's talking to his wife on the riverbed and saying like, I have built this home here. And she's going around showing her mother, like, this was a pigsty when I got here, and now it's a garden, and we have a greenhouse and a pool. And, you know, the mother was endlessly impressed with what, you know, given their meager backgrounds. And, like, if you caught it, everything was so quick and subtle. Like, there's this, the mother's talking about how she used to work for a Jewish family. She would clean for them. And like, yeah, you know, like the reversal of fortunes and all those conversations about how they've improved their personal lot in their current environment, and like the process by which that is, you know, created and maintained. That's the plot. The fact that he gets transferred, and you know, there's this inciting incident where he goes to his wife and says, like, you know, we have to leave. And she's like, fuck you, I'm not leaving. Like, you can go. Like, you go back to wherever the hell it was where it's cold and miserable. I'm going to stay here and live here because this is my home now. And, like, yeah, that seems like that's the plot. But I just think that's not so much an inciting incident as just it's incidental.
And well, I think that's mean. Yeah, it's just this is the thing that's also happening as they just perform their day to day.
Yeah. So like I don't think this film just has that structure that we're used to. And I think it's not an accident. And I don't think that it like I can see why that wouldn't be everyone's cup of tea, but I can also appreciate how it's a choice. You know, like, you know, a lot of people I know complain about, you know, the modern music biopic kind of has all like, you know, like it's like the Dewey Cox story. Like they parodied that because it was so easily parodyable. If that's a word. Where like, you know, this is how these movies go. You tell a story the same way every time. The guy is not famous. He becomes famous. He finds fame hard, and then his life has changed for good or for ill. And, you know, sports stories are kind of the same way. Except for like Rocky, where the story isn't really about boxing. It's about the boxer. And this is kind of like that to me. Like, this is not formulaic. It's not like a story about a concentration camp or sort of, it's just, what is it like to do this day in and day out? And they chose to focus on, like, what does it sound like? If you're going to wall yourself off from seeing the horror, you can't completely ignore it. What does it sound like then? Because that's going to be the only clue you have day in and day out that this is going on. So, like, you're not going to get that structure that we're all used to in a way.
Well, right. Most Holocaust things are about the people in the concentration camps or people trying to get out of them, like freedom fighters and things like that. So you'll have, you know, Schindler's List was about the people living in it and Schindler. So that one has a good arc, and then it's, here's a guy who was running a factory and he learned, you know, decided to become good and was trying to help as many people as he could before the end of the war. And he, you know, saving all those people and what have you, you know. And the newer one, like Life is Beautiful with the boy and his father and all sorts of things. This one doesn't have any of that stuff. No. It's just the constant monotony. And like, it does a good job. Like, it's well made. And the sound especially is important because like, it fades into the background. Like, I did read a review where they said, you know, in the beginning, you're hearing gunshots just randomly as they sit there and talk and have their kid's birthday party. You know, you hear gunshots, you hear people screaming, but then like, you stop noticing after a while, mm-hmm. but they're still going on.
They're still
like,
there. Still, they get the louder.
Gunshots
too,
are still going.
There's one point where someone's not screaming. Like, it's just, my God, that was so hard.
Like, you're just not paying attention. And they're saying like, what do you know? It has the same effect on everybody. And I was like, well, yeah, sure. Of course. I'm watching a mind numbing film about, you know, emotionally dead people. Like, of course that's going to happen. You know, like, I get the point. I just don't want to watch it for that long, because without any kind of a story, it's hard to hold my interest, especially against a subject that's so horrible.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and at the same time, like, it's good to watch a movie that has a different structure every now and again. There are so few movies that have different structures that really justify them. You know, like, I can't think of very many where it's just like the structure to it is really super different. Like,
look at Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
Was there any reason to tell the story in three different time periods like that? It makes the story more powerful, of the story that they're telling, because he doesn't have a traditional arc either.
Right.
You know, so like, a good example of a story that doesn't fit that kind of arc was the Steve Jobs movie I saw with Ashton Kutcher.
Yeah.
Right. He doesn't follow, his life did not follow that pattern of down on his luck to the top, a couple ups and downs, and then he comes out at the end triumphant. Like, that's not what happened. But they sort of tried to graft it onto that. So that's why it like started in weird places and it ended at the point where it ended, where like, he happened to come back on top in Apple, even though there was still like 20 more years of his life to go. And they just sort of hand waved away, like, yeah, bit, 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 bit. So like, you're right, not every story has those kinds of plot formulaic points and things like that. Christopher Nolan doesn't tell his stories in those ways. Dunkirk was the same thing. You know, I'm going to tell you a story, and I'm going to tell it to you in different time frames and different ways of showing you something to make it more powerful that way. Mm-hmm. This doesn't have any of those things. It's just a slice of life. Here's how it is. And since it's so hard to watch with nothing, like, there's not one person you can grab onto, even the girl in the darkness putting food out with the thermal camera.
That was a real person.
Yes, I know, but that doesn't say anything like that.
No.
I had to look it up on Wikipedia. Like, what the hell am I watching here? Why is this girl doing this? Why am I looking at it with a thermal camera? And if you go on IMDb and have it explained to you, it's very interesting. It's like, they could have woven that in somehow. It could have been a whole subplot with a little bit of language to explain why they shot it that way and why she was there. It was interesting stuff. It's just, but in the movie, as I'm watching it, I'm like, what is this exactly?
Yeah, they give you nothing. They don't give you anything. They
well,
really let
there.
You...
They assume that, you know enough about the Holocaust. But they know enough about the Holocaust. I don't need to know that stuff. I don't know anything about.
I don't think so. I think they make choices and they don't, like, it's for good or for ill. It's they give you nothing and you're left to fill in all that yourself. So it's not my favorite kind of filmmaking, but, like, you know, if you were to go and go, like, without having the option to do research and go, who was that? And knowing that that was a specific human being in history who was known for leaving food for people throughout, you know, the concentration camps, you know, trying to keep them alive. You know, this is clearly a person who was putting food. You could tell what she was doing. She had objects in her hands that looked like apples. She was leaving them all over the place. She was running around in the dark at night. There was the scene where he's chastising his troops for, like, doing something about, like, the plants in the area. Like, he was giving them a hard time about how they were interacting with, you know, with the flowers in the area. And you know, you think maybe that was her, like, interrupting the foliage or whatever, but, like, you know, he was interesting in that he had interesting moments with the land and the animals. Did you catch that? Like, he had a relationship with the environment that he was in. He liked to fish there. He liked to go swimming. Like, he was clearly in love with where he was living. And when he finds out he's being transferred, where does he go? He keeps it a secret from his wife for a while, knowing she's not going to be pleased about it. And he tells her perfunctorily at a party, like, oh yeah, we have to leave. She's like, the fuck are you talking about? And, like, she chases him out and down to the, like, to the water. He goes to the water, and they have a fight over there, and then he goes to see his horse, and he has a more tender relationship with that horse than he has with his wife or his mistress, who you meet for 3 seconds, you know, before they go and have sex, and he has to wash him up. Yeah, like,
yeah, he had a mistress, didn't he?
Yeah, like, she, girl, she comes in, takes her hair down. Next thing you know, he's, like, running down to, like, the basement to wash himself before he goes home to his wife. Like, wow, this film is a masterclass in showing and not telling. Which is a lot saying. Like, it's a film about sound. Like, but they tell you nothing. They literally tell you no information. You're just supposed to sort of, like, have it hit you in the face and try and put the puzzle together all by yourself. But there's, you know, why is she shot in thermal? And it's just like, well, she's in the dark. Like, you can't see her. Like, if we lit this scene the way that we would need to for you to see this person doing this, it would look artificial. It would look like, you know, it's like when you watch a movie that takes place in the 1800s and everyone's in a room with candles on the table, but the room is lit up like the 4th of July. Like, that's insane. The only guy to achieve that would be Stanley Kubrick, who shot Barry Lyndon by candlelight by inventing a camera that was so incredibly, you know, powerful that it could take in all the candlelight and actually make it the only light you saw in the movie. There were no lights in that film. So they were saying, we're going to shoot her in thermal because she's doing it in the dead of night with no light whatsoever. So the only way that you could see her is if you had thermal lenses on your eyes. So that's how we'll shoot it. I'm like, okay. Weird, scary. You know, all that Tuvan throat singing going on at the same time was terrifying.
Yeah.
But, like, that's... like, these are all choices that they're made, and they're not giving you anything to go on. And I think it's enough for you to, like, fill in that gap on your own to go, well, why would they do it? Not why did they do it, why would they do that? And then you can kind of make it up as you go along. Like, the ending,
Wait. Slow down. Here's why none of that matters.
Thanks.
It's not, that's not what I mean.
Go on.
So the thing about, okay, it's okay to not tell everybody information so that you can figure it out on your own and trust your audience to go along with the information that they are giving you. Like, you could piece it together enough, like, oh, this is what is happening here. The thing is that this is a movie. This is not history class. So what is it I'm supposed to be getting out of this movie? When I walk out of the door, I'm supposed to go, what did I learn about anything? Humanity, myself, the director, what? Okay, and the girl in the dark putting apples in the dirt and God knows what else. What does she have to do with anything? How is she connected to the family? Is she connected thematically in any way? Does the darkness of her contrast with the lightness of the house? Like, what is the point of that?
Right.
I don't know either.
I don't know either,
but they don't give you anything to even piece it together. So it's one more mysterious part of a film where I'm like, I don't know what I'm looking at, and I don't know why I'm supposed to be looking at it. It's just distracting me from everything else.
And I guess that's the thing. It didn't distract me. It was one more thing I got to consider. Like, why is she there? Because there were people like this. Like, I never considered that there were people within the concentration camp who were doing this. So you don't get to see the real horrors. People being, you know, the babies being decapitated and people being burned alive or gassed to death. Like, you know, you don't see that. But then, like, you do see the things you didn't necessarily know were going on. I didn't know exactly who this guy was. Now I know a lot more about him, how this was accomplished, and, you know, and the people who were fighting against it in very subtle, quiet ways. You know, like, there's just, it was the receipt of information that was not in furtherance of anything other than a curiosity about the experience. And that's, you know, like, you can't make a lot of movies like this. And I'm glad that they don't. And every so often, something like this comes along, and I go, oh, well, this is, you know, a different way of thinking about this. This is, you know, this is new information. This is, or similar information newly presented. And I don't know, like, it didn't bother me that I didn't know who that was. I knew enough of what I was seeing. How did it fit into the big picture? You know, in the same way that the ladies boarding up her greenhouse in the summer fit into everything. Like, it just, like, it was one more thing going on at the time. They were, you know, trying to protect the plants they were growing inside that greenhouse. This person was trying to help the people not starve to death as they were being worked to, you know, to the bone. And, you know, I don't know. Like, I surrender myself a lot more to these things, I think, more easily than some, and so that kind of thing doesn't really bother me so much. Like, I didn't need to know. Like, it was an interesting curiosity that, oh, this was based off of a real person. It wasn't random. The lady, the fact that they had a like, everything in the film was real. The song that the person plays on the piano is a real song composed by a real person who was a prisoner at Auschwitz, and the woman who was playing it on the piano was these are all real people. Nobody in the film was invented. You know, like, I'm sure they, you know, the lady who, you know, the guy who was the gardener who cleaned his boots. I mean, they didn't have his name, but there was a guy who cleaned his boots, I'm sure. Like, so, like, nothing in the film was accidental. And I think that gives me enough confidence to go, I don't have any information about this. I won't get any more. But if I go off the idea that everything I'm watching is based off of a real person and these things really took place, then I can let my brain fill in the gaps in a way. The same way that, like, it's more terrifying not to show all the horror in a horror film, but to let, you know, to have you give you a hint of what's going on and have your brain fill in the gap. It's always much more terrifying than if you just kind of spoon feed every bit of information to people all the time.
I guess.
Well said.
Well, it's not that it's there and it's like there's one mysterious thing that like it's not like a background detail. You know, minutes are devoted to this.
Yes.
So I didn't understand like why this? Why not anything else? When the movie goes to such pains to show what's not going on in the concentration camps.
Yeah. And I mean, it's the difference between when things are haphazard or done for stupid reasons or when they're clearly done for stupid reasons.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's not like when you watch The Batman with Robert Pattinson, and that movie is too long because there are scenes that should have been cut out and they weren't. Scenes that were redundant or didn't go anywhere, like they started threads that didn't lead to any resolutions. I was like, all right, this movie's too long. Clearly, someone in editing didn't do a good job. Here, I'm sure there was a reason for it.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is they didn't do a good enough job showing or explaining or hinting what that is. So it feels superfluous. Like it feels like extra stuff that they didn't need. And I was like, maybe I haven't watched enough movies, but I know enough storytelling to know that this is here for some reason. Like this is not made by some hack. This isn't Birdemic. So then what the hell is the scene doing here?
Yeah.
I just didn't get an answer. So.
Yeah. And I think everyone has a threshold for that. Like, how much of that are you willing to kind of sit there and go, I'm okay with you not being this clear? Like, you know, and perhaps I'm recalling it like, you know, it was about a week ago I saw it. So, like, it's intense. And, you know, I didn't want to think about it for too much longer. So, like, perhaps there are things that I, you know, am more forgiving about than I should be. I don't know. But, yeah. Let's talk about the ending. Because the ending is strange. And I think the greatest licenses are taken at that point in the film. So he finds out that he's being transferred back to Auschwitz to, I guess, continue all the murdering?
Yeah, I think they realize he was fine there, and they're like, he really wants to go, so they sort of just send him back.
I mean, he gets a promotion. That's the whole thing, is that he's like the head of all the concentration camps at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And like it's supposed to be like a big deal, and yet he's just not happy with it, and so he asks to go back. And they let him. So he, you know, he calls his wife, you know, on like a payphone and says, "Hey, guess what? You know, I'm coming home." And there's this, it's incredibly awkward, intense, where he's like, "Yep, good news," and she's like, "Uh huh." And it was clear, like, they're so soulless; they don't love each other. Even they're just, you know, she loves the house, he loves the horse. That's pretty much where they're at with it.
Right. They're not in like love with one another.
No. Mm-hmm. And so I forget how he gets there, but he's in part of this giant Nazi building, and he's walking down the hallway, and it's really strange. Like, it's shot really cool, where like he's walking out of the darkness into like a stairwell, and the stairwell itself is lit up really, really well. But as he goes down, you can see down the corridors, it just fades off into black. There's nothing down there. And so he gets down to the like the next level of the stairs. And do they cut first to the images, or does he start throwing up first? I forget.
I think they do the images first.
Yeah. So like you kind of flash forward 60 years, 70 years to images of the Auschwitz Museum. and you're looking at all the different things, and they're it's to me, it's like it's jarring, but also like, wait, what? It's intense, and then like you're watching people clean it, which I think is a phenomenal choice. It's better than people like you know, tourists milling around looking at it, but you're seeing people who are working at this museum, just kind of like arranging the little partitions for the walk, for, you know, for like the guided tours, and they're, you know, they're cleaning things and putting the garbage away, and all the while there are all these thousands of shoes and suitcases on display of the people who were killed there, and like all these artifacts that are presented to you as part of what had happened there. And then you cut back to him walking down the stairs, and he gets to like the landing, and he begins to retch. Like, he doesn't actually right. throw up. He just retches. And this happens, like, twice. And, you know, then they cut back to the museum, like, in the future, and then back to him in the past. And, like, that's the end of the film.
Right.
Yeah, it just ends after that.
Yeah.
Was this part and parcel of your general, like, what the fuck am I looking at kind of concern here?
No, I knew what it was. It's just... That's like them trying to show that either he did or didn't have some sort of reaction to the things that he was doing. Because all of that stuff is left unsaid, right? So whether or not he felt bad or was choosing to do bad things and was like, I don't care. That's what I want to be. You know, I want to go back to that, to my horse and everything like that. That's left unsaid, which is fine. It's just that the whole rest of the movie doesn't deal with any of that stuff. And he's such a bad person doing such bad things that you're like, I don't care if he feels bad. I can't get 12 seconds of that. Like, if you're going to show me a movie about his inner conflict, do that. You know, you can make it subtle, but this was non-existent. There's no hints of that anywhere in the rest of the movie. So to show it at the end, I was like, oh, am I supposed to believe he feels something here? Because he doesn't for the whole rest of the movie. That was the issue I had.
Yeah.
Not that it was like unsaid, but that it's unsaid and just dumped in the last few seconds.
See, I don't think it was. I mean, it has to happen somewhere.
Yeah,
so
that's fine, right? I'm saying it shouldn't have happened at the end because they don't give you anything up to that point where you should be expecting or looking for it.
Well, I guess my question is like, what if it happens in the middle? Like, what? Like he's. It's at the end of the movie. It isn't at the end of the story. So you do sort of like, if you think of it less like this is the end of the film and more like this is the beginning of this story, like this is the start of this, you know, the Holocaust begins in earnest in 1940-41, and we're still, you know, dealing with it now 80 years later. If you know, at the beginning of the process for us as, you know, a global society, the people who were doing this, as try as they might, could not suppress all of their humanity. Like, he got 99% of it down, like, and then became, you know, and was a monster until the moment that they hung him. But there was a moment, it happened, nobody was around, nobody saw it, where he had a thought, like, maybe this is the worst thing that's ever happened. Maybe I'm responsible for the worst thing that's ever happened. And then you cut to, as the audience, like, this is where we are with it. We, you know, it's now a museum held up as an example of the worst of humanity. And like, which is a fair thing to think it is. You know, even as, you know, as you learn about history and like the brutality of our existence as a species for the last 100,000 years, like we came really far as a species, and this was like pretty recent, comparatively speaking, and we still did this. This was so bad. And so, like, if it came in the middle of the film, I guess maybe it would be interesting to see how he pushed past it to get to the end of his story in the movie. But at the same time, like, you'd expect him to do something different about it, and you know he doesn't. Like, you know, as a matter of history, he doesn't actually change or adjust it. He still kills a million people. And there's the evidence of that million people is all these shoes. So you just get like a glimpse of like 99.9% of his humanity was suppressed, but this 0.1 was still there, and this is what you get. You get not quite throwing up.
Yeah.
And like, look, I have to do a lot of the legwork to get that. And like, I get it. It's me. It's not like,
well, see, that's the thing. It's not history. They're not doing a history film.
No.
They're not. So if you want to tell that story, then tell it. You know, this is like, oh, Jesus Christ, what is this like? Most movies don't do this. You know, we don't, when we watch The Sopranos or The Godfather, we don't watch the day-to-day workings of their criminal empire. And at the end, you have the scene where Michael Corleone looks out the window and goes, maybe I'm doing it all wrong. No, you start in the beginning where, like, it's obvious he doesn't want to be doing these things. And he gets drawn into it anyway. You watch this transformation of the son of a mob's family take over his father's empire and become more ruthless than anybody. That's a story. That's an arc. Okay. If it's what you're going to tell, then tell it. Dramatize it. This doesn't have any drama in that stuff. So to throw that in there at the last second is more confusing than anything. Because you're right. I had to do all that legwork to see just what the point of that was. I didn't know anything about this man until after I saw the movie. And I was like, why did I just watch this? Because they're not showing me anything except that these people were monsters. Which, you know, okay, terrible. And I'm not saying that, but, you know, where's the drama? Where's the excitement? Where's anything?
That's the point. Horror. There's deliberately not any of that. Like that's
well,
not.
That's why I didn't like it.
which I think is, you know, I hate to use the phrase a matter of taste, but like, yeah, if you're looking for that kind of story here, it's not going to be here. Schindler has that story. That's what makes Schindler's List great. Is because it's about a guy who really doesn't have an opinion about being a Nazi. He doesn't have an opinion about the Jews. Fine, whatever. I like to make things in my factory. I need cheap labor to do it. You people are telling me you can provide me with cheap labor. Aces, let's do that. And then very slowly but surely, you know, he realizes, like, wait, if I do this, I can save that person from dying. And like, there's like a sort of a humanity in him that cannot be suppressed. And so he's not going, let's go save all the people, until he becomes obsessed with it. And it's still a numbers game for him. At the end of the movie, which is one of the most powerful scenes that, you know, in cinema, I feel, is when he starts to look at like all of the things that he still has. His car, like it's either a Duesenberg or a Rolls Royce, and he's just like, I could have gotten 12 more Jews for this car. The pin on his lapel, I could have gotten 2 more Jews for this gold pin. Like, he begins to realize that, like, I could have done more, and I didn't do enough. You know, it's the Peter Parker syndrome. It's just like, or it's the Superman syndrome. Like I'm never doing enough. Kind of a thing. And he finds that out about himself in that moment.
Right. And that's
but this is about the, know, the yeah, but this is not about him. It's about the guys who were shooting people at the top of their, you know, it's about the Ralph Fiennes character who, like, you know, rapes and murders everyone he meets. Those people yes. have interesting stories that deserve to be told too, if for no other reason than they are instructive. They're just unpleasant.
The Schindler's List thing is heavy and it's emotional and it's, you know, a little much. These people aren't that interesting. That's what makes the movie kind of dull. They don't change. They don't have any epiphanies. They don't go through anything. You know, we're watching them do horrible work, but bureaucratic work. It's like watching people work at the post office.
And I think that's why we, like I said, the word important before is because, like, I think it's important to recognize that there are things that happen and that are carried out by people who are kind of banal about what they're doing, and yet they're very effective in doing something yeah. terrible.
Right. I'm just saying it's hard to make a movie out of that.
Yes. And I think...
Make it a short film.
I think it could have been shorter, although it wasn't very long. It was like 1 hour 45.
No, and a lot of it is landscape.
Yeah.
You know, and establishing that, like, the hell out of that tree.
And that, like, 8 minutes in the beginning where it's just that sound.
Right. Like,
yeah,
it's did already kind of stretched just a little thin. So
there's a great YouTube guy called Thomas Flight who has a great video about this movie, talking a lot about, like, what was achieved with the sound in particular, that I would recommend that to anybody. Look, they had done a lot of work to make the sound very realistic, and I found that times, we actually haven't talked much about the soundscape, but, like, I found that I was really absorbed in the sound, and, like, I was paying attention to it to the point where, like, as I'm walking around my house later on that night or the next day, as I'm, like, picking things up and putting them down and, like, moving things around and, like, thinking, you know, ice and glasses and things, it's like I was much more cognizant of the noise I was making. And that to me is the mark of a good movie. Like, some other movie did this too. I think Fear and Loathing. I walked out of that like I didn't know where I was for 2 days after I saw Fear and Loathing. But, like, if the thing in the film that was hyper stressed was done so pretty well, like, I can kind of it carries with me for the next, like, 24 hours at least. And he talks a lot about, like, you know, how these things were achieved and how intentional they were and how hyper accurate they were about the kinds of shoes and the kinds of stairs and this kind of stuff. What do you think of the mother that opened Vanish? Did you catch that?
Yeah. She was supposed to have been upset by everything she saw, right?
Yeah. I thought that was interesting.
She leaves a note.
That was the one thing where I was like, I want more information about that. That was kind of an interesting thing. We kind of just, like, I get that you're not supposed to know much about that. But I mean, what the hell could have been in that note that you couldn't figure out in a way?
Because, like, wasn't she, like, looking at the concentration camp that night?
Yes.
And then, like, yeah, so, like, she must have seen or heard something that was, like, shaking her. It's the only hint of humanity in the movie, almost.
Yeah.
Because the mother-in-law goes on about how she used to work for someone who was Jewish, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, she was saying horrible things about them and everything. But, I mean, like,
she even says, you have a Jew in your house. And she's like, well, she's right. just works for us. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, it's showing the depth of, you know, evil and stuff like that in the people who are actually doing that work. And it sort of relies on your knowledge of the Holocaust, that not every single German, Austrian, whatever person, Nazi, was in on this to the extent that some of them were. They might have hated Jewish people, sure. Did they want to burn all of them and to extinction? Probably not. And the closer you got to it, you know, the worse it would be. You know, people always talk a big game, but like, here, you take the gun and shoot everyone like that. And it's like, oh, no, I'm okay. You know, like, so I think it's kind of hinted at that she's, and then the letter, which she immediately throws into the
she burns it right burns. Away. Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah. She just looks at it, takes one look at it, folds it back up, throws it in the furnace, sits down all angry. You know, it exposes that, your willful blindness to that sort of thing. I mean, you are living an idyllic lifestyle next to a place where two million people were murdered. So, like, and to have your own mother or mother-in-law do that to you is, you know, it shakes you out of your complacency.
Yeah.
You know, that's fine. You know, because that's not something that got a lot of information. It trusted you to do the work on your own. That's okay. Like, that's, I'm fine with that. But it just didn't. It was just such a fleeting moment.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, you wanted more of that. But, like, that's, again, that's part of the thing. You want more of what you're not going to get. Because it was the Holocaust.
That's a story. You know, that's the inner lives of these people. Like, if you're going to do a movie about bureaucratic life, you know, when you're watching, or even when you're watching, like, Office Space, you know, yeah. We're not watching them work at Initech doing TPS reports. You're watching them and their personal lives and its effect on working in a soulless corporate cubicle life like Dilbert or whatever. What it does to a person's personality and soul. Like, that's the story. But they don't do that here. So,
yeah. So, yeah, it's all a right, lot. Anything,
you know, yeah.
I recommend
see why
it.
I won a lot of awards.
So. Just know what you're getting into.
You know, if you really don't want to have a good time, you could watch this.
Yeah.
I watched a different movie, and I didn't force you to watch it.
What was that?
I watched To Sir with Love with Sidney Poitier.
Oh, I should watch that one.
It was good.
Yeah, right.
He's very good, so I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And I was like, right, well, I'm going to watch this now.
If you guys have any thoughts about The Zone of Interest, you can let us know. We are on Twitter and Instagram at 3DrinksInPod. We're on Facebook. You can email us at 3drinksinpodcast@gmail.com. Buy the merchandise over at TeePublic. Make sure that you subscribe to the podcast. Leave ratings and reviews. I think that's everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. As always, please drink responsibly, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.